It is November 14th, 2014. And we are doing the second interview with Tom Hamilton, which the first interview we did back in June of this year. So I had a chance to go through the interview last night. It was excellent, but we didn't get any of the questions covered that we normally ask people, but we had. It was a memorable interview. So before I go on, is there anything that you want to be sure that we cover today?
Not particularly. You still had the idea that you wanted to do possibly Herb and I together at some point.
Right.
And that'll probably cover more of the specific stuff relating to the freight weight and
all of the senatorings
and all that stuff, some of which you'll get from Mike Perron, because that was their area of expertise for that whole period in the 90s.
Okay.
So those should be really covered off by the dual interview and with Herb and I.
Okay.
And of course with Perron. Ideally, it should be all three of us.
That's a possibility.
But Mike and Herb were a real team all through the 90s, right up until 2000.
Well, why don't we plan that then? And I think, given the topic, probably having that group is a good idea. Now, I went through, as I said yesterday, just listening to the previous interview. And in the previous interview, we started out talking about the cultures within the elevators, and we talked about not just the ethnic cultures, but just the
operational cultures, the way the management did things, and how
introduction of women into the workforce and the glitches there. But you know, we never really did talk about your career. So I would like to. We actually stopped when you started. Okay. Maybe we could just do a quick review of that now, your career with the grain elevator. So when you started, what you did. Now, actually, we did cover how you had been in an apprentice program for an electrician, and then that is actually how you got on at the elevators.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So.
But I didn't get on as an apprentice. I got on because my apprenticeship, I found it was a fraud.
Yes. Yes.
So I left and went to the elevators at that point.
Yeah.
Temporary.
Right. Yeah. Now, and then you moved west?
No, I moved west before that.
Okay. So let's go then to when you really started working for the elevators. What?
In August of 78.
Okay. Yeah. And in that instance, you talked about, you sort of leapfrogged over the people working in the car shed and went to work. There were two people, two hirers, apparently.
There was two superintendents. Well, it was the superintendent and then his assistant. Bob Antoniak was the superintendent. His assistant was Ray Cousineau. So when Bob was on holidays, Ray took the opportunity to hire a bunch of people that he knew.
Yeah. Are both of those people deceased?
Ray's deceased. Bob's still alive.
Would he be a good person to interview?
I don't think so. He left. I'd have to ask his son. Son lives right beside me.
Well, if you would, that would be great. So when your career really started, what did you do?
You did everything. You were hired, basically it was understood when you're hired, unless you were a technical guy, unless you had papers, that you were hired to be a sweeper, shit gang, they called it, whatever it is. But in our case, because they wanted to train people, they wanted to put us directly inside the plant training. That lasted for 2 weeks until the superintendent came back, and then reverted back to the old way.
The old way being seniority?
Well, you're starting at the bottom. Oh, no, because you were only in training. So there were two people on each job, whereas normally there's one person on each job, and so Ray wanted us trained immediately, and so he moved us around the plant training. So we did that.
With getting a taste for everything, for the general or the most common positions, What did you like and dislike about, you know, if you start at the basement floor, even at the car shed, and work your way up?
Well, the car shed, you were outside, and they had the dust control systems in there, so it was good. And you were fairly busy, not as busy as you would be now because there's less people, but fairly busy, and there was a good routine. You were dumping box cars, so there was active physical work to be done fairly quickly, and it was just a nice atmosphere. Inside was noisy. The car shed was noisy, but not to the same extent. Inside, if you're on a cleaner deck, it was actually pretty boring because there was five people sitting in there, and the work wasn't constant, so you did a lot of sitting around and waiting, and you didn't have to, but that's basically the way people worked. You went out and did some things, and you came back in and waited, and went back out again, and then you were always inside in the dust. And there was this particular belt in the basement that ran six belt or three belt, and it had this really low bass hum, so it would drive you nuts when you're in the cleaner deck. But places like the distributing floor upstairs, where you're moving the spouts around to different bins, that was interesting. You were active there, very busy, and you were closer to seeing what the operation of the plant was like. So it was more interesting, and you had access to the annexes and the scale floor and things like that, so you could see really how the plant operated, the loading of vessels and all that kind of stuff. And tunnels is where it got to be interesting, because then you started blending grains and things like that in conjunction with the inspectors, which has changed, you know, in the climate, probably starting in the late 80s and early 90s, where they just started, the inspections told people what to do instead of the tunnel people actually having some say into what went on. So I think it was a mistake, because he lost a lot of expertise.
Now, when you talk about inspectors, there, my understanding was there were almost parallel teams. There were the government inspectors, and then the company had people doing the same work, where they would be looking at
there were different quality work.
And weighing.
On the inward side of it, mostly for the majority of my career, mostly our job was to get the cars in as fast as possible. So we would do a fairly quick inspection of the cars coming in, and we would grade it according to government standards, but also according to what the needs of the elevator were. So we'd have grades, for example, with HBI written after them, which would be a house grade. So it might be a one red, but it's HBI Durham. So it's got a little bit of Durham in it. Well, upstairs they would say, okay, well, that's one red kernel that's in there, or kernels that are in there, but it's got so many, what did they call that, contrasting classes in there. They would degrade it, and they'd just make that a two red. And we didn't care what they called it, because we would blend it in as a one red. So they would call it a two, the farmers would get paid as a two, and we would sell it off as a one through our blending. So our job in the inspection and in tunnels was to make sure that we maximize that profit margin there.
So who would actually be responsible for, within the company, be responsible for examining the grain and deciding what it is, the house grade?
Our inspectors.
Okay, so they were inspectors.
And if they had, they're inspectors.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay. I was an inspector. So we were trained by government inspectors.
Oh, okay.
But then you learned in each house what, for example, Canada Malt, we had people with us, they knew nothing but barley. So they were inspectors only as far as barley was concerned. They couldn't do anything else. Mm-hmm. And when they took the training, that was recognized by the CGC that that's what it was as well. That's all they were ever going to be doing. If they went to any other house, they weren't going to be able to be certified as inspectors. Mm-hmm. All they knew was the barley and malting barley.
And so you were certified?
No one was certified.
Okay.
For a while, we took courses and were certified as grain inspectors, but the government courses, you were basically certified at the level of grain inspector 3. But we never received that certification. That was only for people who went through the government training and worked for the government.
Okay.
But it was that equivalent. That's what we had to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the exams we wrote. That's what that was.
Mm-hmm. So... Yeah. what would be your comments on how well or not that sort of dual system worked? Was there?
Oh, very well, because it, you know, the farmer was getting a true grade from the grain commission. They weren't necessarily getting the true value of the grain at all, because it, you know, all the dockage and everything was removed, and they got the weight of the grain, and that was and whatever the official grade was, that's what they got paid as. Mm. And they could make a go through a dispute resolution process and get it changed, or you know, come in and have it have a reinspect or something.
Did that happen very often?
We've had farmers in taking a look. In fact, irate farmers coming in and yelling at us, "Look at this, is my grain here. This has nothing to do with us. Go upstairs." And wherever they were sent from there, I don't know if they went down to, I guess they must have gone through CGC downtown.
And where would these farmers have come from?
Out west.
Out west, did they actually
with
come?
With samples of their grain, brought grain right into the plant.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Because they would have taken it to a UGG country elevator and been told it was one thing. And when it got to the elevator, and where, however they were paid, or wherever that final payment came in, it wasn't at that level of grain. So maybe there was a mixing on the way or whatever it was. I'm not sure how the process worked, because like I said, we didn't deal with that. CGC did. So we were, anyway, it worked very well, because CGC did their job, and then we worked within their parameters to maximize the highest grade possible. And then when audits came along, of course, there was overage and unders. We couldn't do too much of that, because if CGC had to be so much too red, we had to have that much too red. So you had to balance things off in that way. So things did end up balancing at in the end, really. So a lot of our profit was made on the how we use the dockage materials.
And what was the process at which elevator you'd be dealing with, your McCabe's or A?
Both McCabe's and A's.
Okay, so. Was there, were there separate bins for?
Oh, everything was separate.
So the dockage went into bins, and then
well, it went
happened?
up to what we called the money makers, and they were the machines upstairs above the cleaner deck. So grains would go to the cleaner deck, then all this other stuff would go up, what they call the byproducts would go up to the machines upstairs. So 1 feet screenings, that type of thing. Those were all saleable products. But no one was, you know, we reclaimed all of that. Everything was reclaimed, including the dust. So there wasn't very, very little waste.
And then what happened to that?
That was all shipped out. Sometimes there'd be orders for that specific stuff. On feed screenings just being little bits of broken grain. Certain seeds you could sell off. At one time we were selling actually straight refuse, canola refuse, because it still had oil in it. Things like that. That wouldn't be determined by us. We would be told, and we'd run our machines accordingly to maximize what we could get out of them. And you're always working in conjunction with the foreman and the millwrights. You know, what combination of sieves or what machines, what speed, rotational speeds, and all this kind of thing to try and get the best out of it.
So there must have been, given all that you're talking about, there must have been a certain, not asking you precisely, but how many different kinds of sieves would there be depending upon whether you're trying to get canola seed out or broken?
We'd run tests even on, as far as on indent type machines too, like the Spuriers and the Uniflows and things like that, the ones that I was showing you at P&H, where they have the rotational, that's a
drum.
Different type of sieve as well.
Yeah.
Or a separator, as we call them. So the more accurate it's better to say separators, I guess. So you'd have triangular ones, you had round ones, you had all kinds of different sizes, from minuscule, tiny, tiny size to, you know, I could practically put my finger in some cases, depending on the size of the kernels. Like if you're doing faba beans or something like that, you're going to, obviously a large kernel, you're going to want more dropping through, just leaving the beans on their own, and then you'd break it down, getting smaller as you went down, right? So each level would have a, so you might sometimes have four sieves, four separate separations. If we were trying to mimic a machine upstairs, most machines, some only had one separation, that's how we test it downstairs. You just set it up so we had a round sieve and say a triangular sieve or a screen with a little, it's not triangular. No.
That you would test
the
it?
The ones that you saw in P&H, those round ones that are about, 14 inches
oh,
wide.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
Just different combinations of those things.
Okay.
Or you could run it over similar through what you've seen before with the Carter dockage testers. So you had mini machines that would mimic what was going on in the plant to see what.
And so then the ones that were actually up on the cleaner deck, would it be, and in the moneymaker section,
yeah,
you're talking
distributor
about,
floor,
they would just
floor
be huge
machines.
Versions of these.
Yes.
Smaller.
Yeah, and often not exactly the same type of machines and not exactly the same characteristics. So you always had to adapt to what you wanted. So like at McCabe's, for example, they would tell us, okay, we want this product. Well, then we'd fool around with different combinations and see. At certain times, I remember we'd, and we had some leeway to fool around with those machines ourselves as operators. And of course, everyone's sort of working together to get that product there. That's what it was. Whereas a lot later on, a lot of the companies just went to do this, run it, which again took away a lot of the thinking that went on in the plant about what it actually was you were doing.
The precision that would be required.
Precision, the problem solving, that type of thing. I think I told you before the example at Richardson's when I went on a tour, I took a union guy there after I retired, and Jerry Hinrich said, you know, we'll go through the whole plant. So away we went. And I looked at the guys in the car shed, and they were on this in this little machine, I guess, and they just came along and opened up the bins. And I said, well, where's your list of what's coming out? They had no idea what was supposed to come out of those cars. None. So, I mean, at our places, you always knew. You exactly knew. And if you opened it up and saw something different, you'd stop it. So why they took away those checks and balances or the involvement of the workers in the actual operation of the plant. I mean, it made no sense to have automatons running around when you could have people that were actually involved in the process for all kinds of reasons. Interest, you know, motivation. Extreme said, you know, at various times to us and to his own company, he says, you know, when they talked about automation, he said, we have a tremendous asset here that we don't want to lose. And he met, I think at that time, I told you this before, we had 130 different types of separate types of grain in the plant. And that's, so there were 500 bins and there was 130 separate types. And they'd all be worked and blended into each other to make the best of what we had.
So in a sense, you were like recipe developers.
We definitely were recipe developers. And then, of course, as I think I told you before, like Warburton Wheat, they actually would send us a recipe of exactly what we had to have, what the proteins had to be, and the types of wheat that had to be mixed in. We shipped it out. We had to ship to those tolerances.
So could you, do you recall what that Warburton Wheat recipe was? Like what made it different than just shipping off?
Characteristics. So they don't care whether it was one red or two red. The government generally, as a general rule, would call Warburton Wheat two red, mostly. We didn't care about that. It didn't matter what the government said. We just took that and you tested the milling characteristics of the wheat, or that would have already been determined by people out west. So they might have something called berry. That was one of them. That had a certain milling characteristics because Warburton Wheat is all for baking. And it's baking the Queen's bread, basically. So it was the Royal Bakery. So they would know what the milling characteristics were of this specific, very specific wheat. So we would have that into the plant, segregate it, very seriously segregate it, as, you know, just like you would for any other valuable product. And they would basically tell us what the mixture had to be. And we would adhere very, very strictly to that mixture.
So tell me how...
Of proteins and actual varieties.
So, how and who is the team that's brought together to get it mixed and just...
The order comes into the management. The management comes into the inspector. The inspector sits down, looks around where he has the various types, what size design of the bins are, like if it's a big bin with a certain type of opener in the bottom, a smaller side bin with a whatever. He knows he has to get so many tons out of each bin to make the product that they're asking for. But he also has to know, and the tunnel people have to know, the characteristics of how fast that grain runs out. So that's where you start to get back into the thing where people had to be involved in the whole process all the way through, which for years they hadn't. So that created a problem at the start because we had people down there who just go and open it, wheat is wheat. And then we'd find these bins open. Well, all of a sudden you get 500 tons of this has already gone out and 40 tons of this when it was supposed to be 200 and 350. So you're all screwed up and now you have to try and figure it all out and so hope it's not all in one hole. Get the recipe back up so the final shipment, because in some of them they did a total shipment breakdown instead of a whole breakdown. So you had some more leeway in, because it would blend all at the end then when they were bringing it out. They weren't loading and segregating each hold, or unloading and segregating each hold. So you had a better chance to, you had a chance to fix up the recipe. But the inspectors and management would just go nuts about, you know, there's no way. These guys have to know. Two notches is two notches, not four. You know, and sometimes it wasn't the tunnel people. Sometimes it was the inspectors not knowing themselves. And they would say, put so-and-so bin on. And they wouldn't quite know what the characteristics, flow characteristics of the bins were.
So would they... would they rely exclusively on what they saw on the bin diagram, or would they do an actual physical investigation of each bin before they opened it?
No, most of us knew, because people were talking about they were all senior people, you know, and most of us knew how the bins ran out. Mm.
So, to somebody who ate it at a time, or are they all...
Some places that didn't have the confidence in their people would only do one at a time. So they would start with, like Viterra, for example. They started, when our people went over there, they couldn't believe it. They'd start with the one bin and they'd run 100 tons of that. And then they'd run 200 of something else instead of doing it all together.
And where would they be running it to?
They'd be running it to the scale and then right out to the vessel.
Okay, so every scale hopper...
Yep.
Could have a separate blend. Okay.
Yeah. So, like, if you were running into one hold, and you had to have that that recipe for that hold, obviously you'd do a lot less leeway. You only had, 4,500 tons to play with around. And so you had to be much more careful, right, in those things. When you were doing a whole shipment, you had more room, of course.
And really, what implications would this have for the inspectors, the government inspectors, it was all going to come out. It's all going to come out visually as
too red. Is what they called it. Generally, as a general rule, they called it too red. We didn't care what they called it.
Right.
It made no difference.
Yeah.
But of course, if they all of a sudden, if one of them said, "Okay, well, we're finding heated or something else in the thing," then and somehow we'd missed it. Well. Thank God we still had a working relationship with them, you know. So they would still do stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it was more between the, as more and more it is these days, more between the customer and the company.
Mm-hmm. So we sort of stopped as you were heading up the elevator talking about the different positions and what you liked and didn't like. So obviously you enjoyed the floor where you actually had to do some thinking. So
any of the positions where you were able to... yeah, you had to do some thinking. It made the job interesting because the elevators can be a tremendously boring place, as any place can be. It can be a tremendously boring place to work. So you better find some way to take an interest in when you're spending 8 to 13 hours a day in a plant.
Mm-hmm. Floor, I don't think we talked about.
What
did you like and not like about that floor?
Well, the scale floor, the receivers basically ran off fairly early on, computerized machinery to, you know, assist in elevating, weighing, and distributing the grain, and so did the shipping. Because at both plants I worked at, they'd gone past the manual scales by the time I got there. So they were fairly modern. And so the job I liked there was the cleaners, because you had, again, the combination of physical work. You had, in our case, we had 7 banks of cleaners, all possibly running different things. And again, you were involved in blending and stuff like that. Plus you're running around opening everything manually. You're working cooperatively with the cleaner deck, with the inspector downstairs where these things went, with the receivers and shippers, because you had to coordinate the belts and what they wanted to get to next, and what was shipping on a boat, should it run some stuff into there. So they're all active, very dynamic position. You had to listen to everything that was going on the radio, whether it was D-floor guys, the annex, what they were doing in the tunnels. So you were fully involved in all aspects of the work. Plus you had to remember you know, 7 and 8 different things all at once, which was tremendous exercise for your head. I heard one time that people can only do about 7 different things. And lots of people can't do more than one, really, 1 or 2. So it was a really good multitasking exercise, and that went on for years. And your day was a very good day. You were happy at the end of the day. You were stressed out lots of times, but... So a combination of physical work and being very involved in the operation of the plant.
Did we... Shipping floor, did we talk about it?
That is part of the skill floor.
Okay.
Any of the control positions at Grain, or United Grain Growers, or it was McCabe's, or at A House, or at Pool One for that matter, they were all on the same floor. Mm-hmm. Whereas at Richardson's, there was a split and things like that. So all of our control room or scale floor functions were always together. Mm-hmm. We were never separated. And same as our government people. We worked on those floors. We worked side by side. I mean, literally side by side with the government people, mainly the way staff. And downstairs, we worked, you know, basically shoulder to shoulder with the inspection staff. That also was different from other plants. So
it made for a very good... In what way? Like they didn't work together? They were quite separate?
No, quite separate. Pool 7 are in a totally separate office. The only thing they saw was paperwork. Lots of times, the people working in the elevator wouldn't even know who the government people were, inspectors or the way staff, which again doesn't make any sense because you're partnering with these people.
Was that a philosophical difference between UGG and other operations rather than just a physical plant setup?
It was easier to have them sitting together for one thing, but everyone's together. You know what's everyone knows what the other hand is doing. Mm. And if you're sitting and running a boat, you're running into problems, they're well aware of what's going on at all times. So you're constantly working together with them, and sometimes it was an advantage for the government. They can immediately tell us to cease and desist or alter whatever we're doing or something. Worked very well. In audits, the government people were critical to us, you know, in helping out and
critical in a good sense?
In a good sense, in our experience, yeah. I can't speak for the other elevators, how they worked. Like I said, at our company, we had a really good working relationship with the government staff.
What did an audit entail?
Basically took every bit of grain that was in the plant, of all types, and ran it from one bin into another. If we had to make up, if we knew on our own audits that we were short of 3 red, we would have to do some blending in there so that we would come up with 3 red. The government would grade it. Everything we shipped out, the government would grade. They didn't care where it came from, they just where it went to. Then they would grade it and they'd say it's 3 red. So we wanted to come out with so much 3 red. Same with 2 red, 1 red, Durham's, whatever it is. So every bit of grain was turned over and we tried to blend it so we could, number one, not lose money by being short on various grades, but being over was good too, but not too much over. So our company would make money that way if we came out with more than we actually were supposed to have, which I didn't want to really go too crazy on that stuff. So anyway, the government was monitoring on this, and we relied on their, in that case, we relied on their official grade for all of that stuff. And then we went back to our own.
How long would it take you to shift a bin from?
Not very long, no. But I mean, the overall audit, in the old days, we'd work, 2 to 3 weeks running 2 to 3 shifts. Slower in those days, isn't it? In the more modern era, they started to do a lot. Like you could actually audit some cars coming in. You could audit to a vessel. You could do this and that. So I remember working one audit where I think we only had something like 100 tons of grain left in the plant that had to be actually audited and turned over. So you said, it didn't even take a day. So
there was an improvement in the whole process.
Or you didn't have to shut down operations. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what the company's argument was always, why should we shut down operations to do this? We should be able to do it, find a method to do it. And of course, there was some method found to do it that way.
Was this a yearly thing?
No. No, there used to be a fixed term, and you could get an extension on that, but then that was it. You couldn't get any further extension. So I think the maximum was 4 years between audits, including the extension, and then after there wasn't any fixed term. It was, in fact, I don't know how they determined when we should have an audit or not, or whether it was up to us to do it.
When you think,
I think there was, because I remember a company saying that they were going to choose to do the audit because they knew we were in a good position to do it, so they were going to call the audit at that point.
Mm-hmm. Now, you tried out every floor. Did you eventually become a specialist in one area?
Well, you never really did, because it depended on the workload. You know, even I had postings fairly early on in my career, because I asked this Bob Antoniak, my first superintendent. I said, you know, as a rookie, I said, should I apply for everything? He says, Tom, apply for everything that comes up. You know, there's always a chance people don't apply. They think they're not going to get it. And I did get some jobs that way.
So what were some of the jobs that you had, the sort of official postings?
Oh, inspector, annex, head cleaner, operator from the scale floor. Well, I mean, there was D floor person.
D floor being?
The distributing floor, where you're moving the spouts around to the different bins. You know, all of the jobs except the dryer. And except for dumper man in the car shed. You know, actually operating the tipping the boxcars, emptying the boxcars. Mm-hmm. So those were the only two jobs I didn't do.
So when you take a look at over that time period and the various positions, what are the most memorable situations, both positive and negative, related to sort of the grain process? We talked about cultural stories, but just
working at McCabe's overall, when it was struggling, when it was an automatic, when in the early 80s, and that when we worked at McCabe's, it was, you do so and so many cars, you go home, and this and that. It was much more relaxing. There was a lot of people there. So you just went there. It was like going to any other elevator, except it operated a little differently than UGG A House over in Kern River. But in the 90s, and just about all the 90s, it was always under threat of closure. So those of us who worked over there, it was a very small team that went there whenever it was operating. And doesn't mean every time it was operating I was there, because I may have had another job over but whenever at A House. So you had a little team trying to do all these interesting things to keep the place going. And everybody was in the same boat. We were, management was, didn't make any difference. And the union was, everybody was doing the same
job. Who were the managers at, or who was the manager of McCabe at that time?
Well, Billy Green was the superintendent of all the, of both houses. He ran both houses. He was the actual guy who we deal with. There were foremen, there was a number of different superintendents. It didn't really make any difference. Some better than others. Rob Hollingsworth was one. Derek King was another. Derek King's still active. Robbie just retired, but he's been off sick for years and years. Could be some other foreman like Greg Eby. He might have been sent over there every now and then. It could be Bill Green himself, Laurie Powell, who committed suicide. And Kenny O'Connor.
So they were operating as a team to try to keep things.
We all did. That's the way you worked there. You didn't want to go over there unless that's what you wanted to do. And whether it was in a car shed, whether it was in the running the cleaning machines, doing whatever. Mm-hmm. You had a really good crew that worked together. It's a smaller crew, right? And there's sort of a sense of purpose in it. Whether it was with A House, it didn't matter. A House was going to run. It was running. It was healthy. And we had all the grain for it up until these buyouts and everything, our acquisitions came up. But the McCabe's was a different thing. we all knew the, I remember us being called in one end of June, I guess it was. And they told us, that's it, no more. It's finished. You're all going over to Ahaus on Monday. Well, we knew there were boats the next week. We knew where there were this and that, but this guy, who's Gary Cotola, he was the superintendent at that time running both houses, says there's no work. Well, the foreman, the superintendent over there, just looked at us and he didn't know what the guy was talking about. We know there's work. Well, so we said, where should we report to on Monday? And I said, well, come here. He says, we'll figure it out after, because we know there's a boat on Monday. We have to work all weekend to clean canary seed for it. We never left McCabe's. But he told us, called us all in and told us this thing, that it was done as of the next day. Mm. We worked there 4 more years after that. You know, there was, so we always said about him, he says, whenever he said they're doom and gloom, it was a banner year. You know, but that was nice, because again, in all of the work at the elevator, you needed to, my opinion always was, you had to be involved. Whatever it is you're doing, you had to be involved, you had to take interest, just like in life, mm-hmm. or else you're not going to have a very good life, either in work or anyplace else.
Started my question with wondering about things that happened. So, for example, having to unload a ship that's already been loaded, any of those kinds of incidents occur, leaving a bin open and grain all over the place?
Oh, lots of those type of things happen. I mean, we came in one time, we couldn't see to the back end of the tunnels, and I thought, oh, the guy hasn't turned the light on. But a bin had let go at the roof. So the whole, there was actually a slide right up at the ceiling, which is basically the top of the hopper, was below that bin, and it had either fallen out, rusted out, whatever it was, and it came out, so all of the grain just right up till it filled up right to the roof. So that's why we couldn't see back there. And the guy couldn't start the belt or anything. Nothing could be done about that. We just had to go back in this little wee space, you know, smaller than this room, with no room to move, and you had to shovel all that grain out of there. Put it somewhere and get it out over to another belt. And vessel was by hand. It was another one doing it with, you know, shoveling it off.
How do you do that? Because you're down in a hold. How do you actually shovel it out?
Into pails and things like that, and up it went. Shoveling, thank God that was only a little bit. Then with the evacuator, well, the evacuators that most of the plants had, would only do maybe 7 tons an hour. So then last one they did, we had a Dutch fellow come in, I can't remember his name, a very nice family. And I think he was able to do, I think his capacity was 150 tons an hour. I think we got about 60 tons an hour. Huge improvement. And we worked all day until about 10:30 at night getting grain off on that one. Because there was no marine lake we could go to. The Sasspools Marine Lake hadn't operated in years. And then a situation like at Richardson's last year, yeah, I guess it would be 2013, where if you remember they had the wrong grain. You know, those type of things happen in the elevator all the time. Or not as a regular occurrence, but enough that it wasn't all that strange. It was funny. Pool one, the superintendent looking out his window and looking over at McCabe's and calling up Laurie Powell, who was the manager or superintendent at that time at McCabe's, and told him he was loading a boat. And Laurie said, what do you mean? He says, well, he says, you're pouring mustard right into the slip. Somebody had turned the distributor dial to the shipping spout, and they thought he was shipping it to the annex. So he was shipping to the annex. It was going right. Mustard was very expensive, as you know. Out it went, right onto the dock and into the slip.
So what kind of sanctions for that behavior? Just considered mistakes and that's it?
Well, in that particular case, we know who did it. It wasn't one of the workers. So it was a management person who did it, who was touching a dial who shouldn't have been touching. And he couldn't really deny it because there was no one else.
I'd like to sort of make a side trip to talk about the Current River area where the UGGA was. So when you started, was Pool 9 still there, Alberta Pool 9?
No, it had just been taken down, Pool 9.
I started after that.
So it must have been taken down in, what, mid to late 70s? And I never actually saw Pool 9 when I was there. Our pellet plant wasn't there. I guess you could see parts of the tunnels in it, but the actual building had been taken down. I can't remember exactly what year, because I had nothing to do with the mm-hmm. elevators prior to 78. Well, except when I was hired to play hockey, and had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm. So the that particular plant, the UGGA, mm-hmm. had toppled over. Was there any lore about that?
No, not really. I didn't find out Norm Nuttall. Probably a number of them had, but it was funny. It was a lot, very, very little talk about it around there. I found more about it after I retired than, or on my own later on.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we, and all of the people I started with, all of the senior men were all part of that. They all were part of the recovery, or certainly were mm-hmm. around when it was, when it had fallen in. It was amazing how little was said about that. Even the Pool 4 of explosions, there's very little said about.
Yeah.
And a lot of our guys were there when it blew up. They were right beside it. You know, knew all about it, were involved in it, families were involved in it, and it just wasn't discussed.
Hmm. So you said you learned more about the UGG situation after the fact. Is there anything you can add to...
No. There was some hearsay stuff I had from an engineer that, I'd rather if he talked about it,
mm-hmm.
and he may already have talked to you, I don't know. He had already made preparations to rebuild that plant. Those things don't happen in a week. The decisions don't happen in a week. The plans don't happen in a week. That was very, very fast. So they knew at some point they were going to have to redo that or do something with that annex, whether they'd intend to knock it down at some point and rebuild. I don't know, but that it was amazing. As you know, the whole process was a year, right?
Mm-hmm.
From the time it went down until... It was from September to December. September 1 year to December the next. And that, imagine that happening today. I mean, so it was wonderful the company could make that decision and spend that money and that commitment.
Mm-hmm.
But to have those plans in place and to start it that quickly, something funny there.
Moving on to talking about, because I know your time might be limited or is limited to time that the whole configuration of companies along the waterfront changed. Could you sort of take us through that and how it felt to be in that at the time? First of all, just talk about what happened, how...
See,
what
we,
kind
we
of...
started with, when I started working, it was generally thought about 7 to 9 years before you would start to work full-time. And that's the way people thought, that you'd be there that period of time, and you'd get to full-time, and then you'd carry on like that. In my case, I probably started working pretty well full-time year-round in the, probably 1980. Excuse me. And then after about 85, we started seeing what was happening with, when did the Russian, Mulroney was in power and they lost the Russian grain. Mid-80s, I think. 83 to 85, somewhere in there. So we didn't see it with Cargill, we didn't see it with P&H, we didn't see it with Manitoba Pool, although Pool 9, they were no longer operating, and it was gone, like I said. But Sasquatch Pool started to disintegrate. You know, huge company that had, what, 1,500 employees, I think, on its own. And they'd just done tremendous work on Pool 4, revamped, I think, the whole cleaner deck, things like that, and next thing you know, it was shut down. So then we got into the changes in the 90s and that, which Mike will go through, he and Herb. And then we had in the mid-80s, the first hint we had was Continental Grain came in and they wanted to lease and operate McCabe's. So that was the first real hint, along with the downsizing at starting at Sasquatchpool. Of course, there was downsizing happening all the rest of them because there were efficiencies, but not like Sasquatchpool. Sasquatchpool was actually losing tonnage. We weren't. I mean, changing how, what work you did on different shifts, all of that stuff, that's all separate from that. So it resulted in a lot of job losses. But the first hint of consolidations for us would have been when Consolidated wanted to come in, they would take over McCabe's and operate that. And Consolidated at that time was one of the top four, I believe. I think it was Cargill, Consolidated. Land O'Lakes was up there. I can't remember who the rest were. For some reason, that fell through, but that sort of was a bit of a wake-up call for us that things didn't, along with the SAS pool stuff, that things may not necessarily stay the same.
So let me just stop you there, but mm-hmm. I don't want you to lose your momentum. So when you started, what was still operating on the Cam River, anything?
Wouldn't have a clue, because okay. we pretty well worked with the plants that you possibly might go to work in, and those grain, or they take ours or whatever it was, Richardson's to a certain extent, but very little attention paid to what was going on with any of that mm-hmm. other stuff.
So
very
back
insular.
So back to the first hint you had, was this Consolidated one, or
yeah,
Continental, or Continental, or
Continental.
Continental.
It was consolidation there, like or different ownership coming in and this and that, and how would it affect the terms of collective agreement and blah, 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 that stuff. But anyway, the then ADM, in the 90s, for us, I'm talking about at grain growers, then is there the issue of there not being enough grain to possibly keep McCabe's going. And so that took over much of our thoughts. And then Manitoba Pool wanting to take over United Grain Growers. And that was in, I guess, the early 90s. And I remember Brian Mallon, Brian or Billy, I can't remember. I think it was Brian. He walked over from Pool 1 to then was Derek King of that plant. And when Derek came back from a tour of the plant, Brian was sitting at in his chair behind his desk, and he says, "You won't be needing this anymore." That was the first hint we'd heard that there was going to be a sale to Manitoba Pool. And Derek was just shocked, and of course the rest of us know what's going to happen, the whole deal. And then, of course, nothing happened there because ADM came in, and there was a poison pill agreement, and ADM came in and bailed, you know, Grain Growers out.
Archer Daniel Midland?
Yeah. And that agreement was in place, I believe, from 95 to 2005 for them. And ADM continued to own shares right up until 2007 when they sold off to Sasquatchpool, when Sasquatchpool was buying, you know, at that time, Agricore United. And the next thing for us in the 90s was the Alberta Pool takeover of Manitoba Pool. And we saw like 22 people at that time were terminated.
Not Alberta Pool.
Yeah. Before it was Manitoba Pool, Alberta Pool had an elevator here, but they never operated an elevator here. Manitoba Pool operated their elevator. And I don't think there was ever an Alberta Pool elevator here that was operated by them. So anyway, they took over Manitoba Pool. And there were changes there. And around that time was the time when Pool 3 was temporarily mothballed. And then by August of that, in the early spring, and by August of that year, it was determined it would be shut down permanently. Then you saw the combination of those two workforces there, two different cultures again coming together. I only know this part of it because of I was involved in, but not to any serious extent other than safety. But just from people who worked at the various plants, they're talking about what it was like in the two cultures coming together there and the loss of work and this and that. And then the next thing would have been Cargill was going to take over Richardson's. And that would be around the two. The point with all of that was, and there was another one in there too, is that the people at Manitoba Pool were the people who were affected more than anybody else other than Sasquatchpool on the waterfront, because every year, in some cases, a matter of months, there would be a news story about those people being merged with someone, bought by someone or whatever. So, you know, for me personally, both working at that plant, I was involved, I was president of the union from 1999 on. So it was very nice to go and talk to the Manitoba Pool guys, because they knew exactly what all the implications were for these various moves and how it would affect them, at least knew enough to ask the questions. Whereas the other people were still, the Richardson's people, that were still stuck in their, were safe, were in our own little castle type of thing. So the, you could say the Manitoba Pool people were prescient in that way. And we really enjoyed working with them because, you know, they listened and asked questions, things like. And then something did happen, because I remember July 28th or 30th, Billy Green came in 2001, and it was supposed to be Cargill buying Manitoba Pool. And what it was the two companies combining, Agricor and United Grain Growers, to form Agricor United. The question that remained, and there was a labor board hearing about that as well, was the who bought who? Was it a merger? Does the collective agreement kick in? Or protections kick in? You know, who's who as far as seniority goes, because if one bought the other, it depended, it was very important about who the actual purchaser was, about where they would end up in seniority. And anyway, the prediction made at that time that it would probably be in another 5 years before something else happened, if Sasquatchpool at that point didn't collapse. Because if you remember, all through that period of time, Sasquatchpool was just teetering. It was from 2000, actually from the 90s on, but it was just teetering. It didn't day to day at some point. If you talk to any of the managers, including Pat Bushby, I think he'd probably tell you he'd wait until 10 or 11 at night, expecting the phone to go to call or a phone call to come, and then he would go to bed, knowing he could work the next day. But, so there was that, all that going on as well. And what else was happening then? Anyway, our company that I'd worked for all those years, that became Agricor United, looked to be doing very, very well. But in 2007, when Sasquatchpool made its offer, and Richardson's made its offer, you know, when you actually looked at how our company was doing okay, but it was more that they were hiding their head in the sand a bit. They were the biggest. They thought they'd keep on going like this, that nobody could do anything about them. Well, they had no reserves. They had nothing to fight with. They had no cash. They had nothing. They'd never really realized all the synergies they should have out of the initial buyout. They had, thank God, merged our pension plans, so that was one thing that was helpful to us for long-term security. But anyway, going back into 2000, in 2000, Herb and I had predicted, and Mike Perron, that we'd have no more than four companies operating in the waterfront within 3 years. And basically that's what came out. We knew the consolidations were coming. And that's when I'm going back to talk to what I said, we're talking with the Manitoba Pool people. They were the only group in the waterfront that actually believed what we were saying about that, because they knew from our experience and their experience that was going to happen.
Now, just curious about how did the union get the reconnaissance? Like, were they in discussions with the various companies, or do they have a special investigation group that...
Oh, no, we're a member of all kinds of different organizations out west. You're talking with the, at that time you're able to talk with, like Murdoch Piquet, for example, came from our plant. You know, we cleaned bins at our plant. I cleaned bins with him. So he was the head guy in a grain growers concerned with us. We were talking in a much more open way in those days about things. Like, we'd have meetings all the time. I go to meetings at the railway with various companies, with Western groups that had nothing to do with here other than we're all involved in the agriculture. And talk about all the issues coming up, whether it was Churchill, how Thunder Bay was going to be affected, what needed to be done. We knew we were way over capacity. I mean, not anyone could see that. If you're going to operate, you didn't need that capacity. We were way up operating at a much lower efficiency level than we needed to be to get our costs down to where we were able to compete in some way with the West, with going south, with going through Churchill, with railing by, with the special rates that were given for that. Or, I mean, with the little bit unfair competition with the change in the freight rate. We knew there had to be consolidation. You couldn't, a business could not go on operating. What other changes were there that...
There was computerization.
We were very afraid that the companies, the union was very afraid that the companies were not going to be able to respond to the new climate that was created in the 1990s. And we were proven right on that in a number of ways. And we go back in negotiations, we talk to them about it practically every negotiation. And we set up an interest-based negotiation so we could deal with, never mind what's in this little book, we're facing problems here as an industry, let's see what we can do about it. What can we do about it? What can you do about it? But they had gone for years and years, and I don't know any other business that operates that way, where they didn't have to worry about profit or loss or anything else, like our company. Everything was given to them. The grain was all given to them. They were guaranteed that grain every year. They had so many country elevators out west. They had nothing was pooled. Remember, it was all sent out to us, depending on the shares we had. We had allocation meetings every week with the railways, and the wheat board was involved. Remember, we had the grain transportation
agency.
The meetings every week on that, so we had a good idea of what was going on all across the country, what was coming into the plants. We could know. We'd know a number of weeks ahead or months ahead of different things. When that structure all started and deteriorated from 1999 on, right? So there was less and less and less of that sure thing.
And was that less and less just a result of less product, or was there other things
happening?
No, lots
of product. It was just the whole structure of how grain was being gathered and shipped to the export points, and how it was going to go, where it was going to go. What companies were going to get what, this type of thing. The very close working together of all the parts, where they might be sitting and fighting all the time, but at least they got, at the end of the day, like some of these meetings were weekly meetings. Everyone had a good feel of what was going on. All of a sudden, a lot of that was taken away, so it was left to your own logistics department and dealing with the wheat
board. Why was that taken away, do you say?
I don't know why all of that stuff was taken away. That's like the GTA. Why was that taken away? You know, the car allocation policy group. Why was that taken away? I mean, you sit down and deal with the issues as they come up with the railways and with the, because you knew you were always going to have ongoing problems with logistics. The shipping companies, less and less vessels on the waterfront. So you had to make everything, so you wanted everything to work, to be more coordinated, not less. Like when you say with the wheat board coming down, the possibility there could be some inefficiencies in how things are being shipped out right to this day. So we could see all of this stuff as a union and it's borne out in our what we discussed in our negotiations, starting in for sure 2000. Actually, mm-hmm. It started in 1993.
Yeah.
Tell you the truth.
Yeah, and
but looking at, we never understood why the companies would not, didn't seem able to react. It's like, what do they call it, inertia? It's like things will right themselves eventually. Maybe they will, but there has to be some, and we were very concerned when the wheat board left, because we knew there was some positioning taking place with other companies outside. We knew the wheat board itself was positioning itself in such a way that it could survive, which it was, I thought, was doing a very good job of. Then all of a sudden, when it was going to be thrown to the companies, we didn't have any faith in that the companies were going to be able to source the grain, get the logistics going and everything else. No faith in that at all. Some of the companies have. Richardson's were really proactive, really, really proactive. We love to see it. They're proactive in the whole thing. It doesn't matter what you talk about, whether you're talking about inspection, services being changed, Richardson's immediately went into training, long before it ever happened. Very, very proactive. And that's what you want to see. Anybody does. If you're running a company and I'm an employee of that company, I want to see that that's what they're doing. Not stick in the mud, like you see with Viterra or people like that. Or not head in the sand stuff. So it was always puzzling to us as the people who worked, and they would say, it's not your business. And we would say, yes, it is our business. we're the ones who work here. We've been here for years and years. This is our career. We're not just, you know, part-time fly-by-night people. We're very concerned. We want to see that something's being done about this stuff. Mm-hmm. And anyway, a lot of that stuff was less and less communication exists to this day. Mm-hmm. Like right now, Herb has very little communication in any meaningful way as the USW staff rep with the various companies there or agencies out west or anything like that.
We're running out of time.
Other days.
Yeah. But I do want to maybe just wrap this up then with what kind of toll did that take on, I mean, as an outsider, when, you know, I've interviewed people various times who had, you know, started their careers in 1940 mm-hmm. through to people like you and even later on. It was fun to work in the elevators.
Oh, well, a tremendous amount of fun. It was fun to work in the elevators for most of us. And I'm saying most of us because it's like a parfait or whatever. It's all separate. The group for Stéphane Turgeon, who you interviewed earlier on, was in. A lot of the time, it wasn't fun for him to work in the elevators because they were stuck in that in a bubble of people who were hired. They still needed them, but they weren't going anywhere. So they'd spend 20 years on shit gang. No opportunity to go anywhere. Thank God he was able to get something into the CGC near the end of his career, at least have some opportunity to spend the last 15 or 20 years of his working life in a good way. Thank God some of our other people left when they saw that happening. But there was a tremendous amount of people who were squashed down by people like us who were just, you know, might be a day senior. Makes a huge difference. There's a guy one below me who never in 30 years worked a full year. Like I worked a full year almost every year of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, and the opportunities to work in different places in the elevator and to be involved and to work with the millwrights and things like that, all kinds of, they never got those chances.
So was it a situation then when it stopped being fun? Correct me if I'm wrong, but I can't imagine that when you're sitting there, as you mentioned, you know, Saskatchewan wheat pool person, 10 o'clock at night wondering whether he was going to have a job tomorrow. Like, that must do something to the whole working atmosphere.
Oh, definitely. The working atmosphere at Sask Wheat Pool for years and years and years, and I'm going a long time, going back at least 20 years, is absolutely terrible. The morale situation has been terrible. I know people who work there who come in and do their job and then go up and sit in the lunchroom, and I were asked specifically, I said, well, you know, how does it work? Who sits beside you? He says, I don't know, some guy. That's unheard of where I worked. Unheard of. Mm-hmm. You'd at least know who you were working with. You'd take some interest in that type of thing. No, just going in. I used to watch them going into work. It was like, is it, they're going to the gulag and then coming back out again at the end of the day. There's not a smile on anybody. Terrible atmosphere in the lunchroom. You know, they're just very, very odd. We would ask people in Zas Wheat Bowl, and we had some of them in the union executive and that, how things were. And they would say, oh, good, everything's fine. And then you'd find out later what actually was going on, and we'd tell them, he says, you know, that's we just don't do that. That's not the way things are done, you know, for your health, for the company's health, for the whole deal.
For example of that? Like, that's just not how things are done, what?
Well, the way they work, say, overtime distribution possibility, something like that. What are some other ones? How postings were done, how people advanced in the elevators. There were side deals made, different deals, like a union steward might make a deal with a foreman here about doing some kind of work. It was all behind the back stuff. Very little of which happened where we worked in. It was wide open. We were just lucky. Terrible problems with management all the way through, right from Bob McKinnon was in the 90s, and then I'd say people hated him then, but he probably over the years was probably one of their best managers, so you can imagine what the rest of them were like, including this idiot who's there now. Bushby, he's absolutely terrible. But they don't have any attachment, there's no ability to work with people. It's terrible, terrible, terrible the way it is. But they don't, half the time they don't know it. Like some of the guys I brought into the union from there have their eyes open now, and they look around and see different things, and or even at a place like P&H where you see a guy like Steve, who now is tremendously interested in all kinds of things. He's coming in, he's going to take over my computer work and that kind of stuff. And I've never had a SAS group, one person from SAS group I've had to do that.
Was there a difference in companies versus the companies that the management of the company supported the union? I mean, there's always a pull and push between management and union, but there's, you know, there's philosophies of yes, union.
SAS Group is a backwards organization. 1978, the Canadian Labor Code put out a guideline for dust and how you deal with blowdown situations and things like that. Every other company developed procedures to go along that way. And as you develop procedures, you change some, you deal with the Canada Labor Code people, and you deal with those people depending on what the circumstances of what you find out and everything else. And you come up with a policy at the end of it. After I retired, when there was an issue that came up at SAS Weeple and the guys came to me about it, they brought me their policy. The policy was the recommendation made in 1978 or 77 by Labor Canada. They had done absolutely nothing from that day till 2012 to develop any policy, to think about what was. All they did was take that, put it in their file box and say that's what the policy is. That was never what it was intended for in the first place. They never understood it. And I talked to Bob Antoniak, who was the superintendent up to and actually managed all of Grain Growers operation in Thunder Bay. I'm going to say till around 83, I could be wrong. I talked to him within the last 5 or 6 years and told him some of the things about SAS people. And he says, Tom, he says, when I was the manager in Thunder Bay for UGG. He said, we never could get them to deal. He said, I'm not talking as a competitor. I'm talking about trying to deal with them. Never could get them to deal. Never do anything progressive. They just did what they did. It was their way. And I said, that what they call now, and I said, Bob, is if I tear away. And he says, that's what they said then. It was just, this is the way we do it. That was their answer to everything. This is the way we do it. Whether it's wrong, whether you have a millwright, and this is true, millwright downstairs in 2005, 2007, with a hand snipper, snipping, had at least a lever cutter, a drop shear or something like that, they wouldn't do it. That's the type of work they have their people doing. A waste of management's time, a waste of their time. When all the rest of us changed to progressive materials, they stuck with this. I don't know where that philosophy came from. I don't know if it had anything to do with the co-op system. I don't know if it was just the nature of the managers in Thunder Bay. What it was, they are and have been a stick-in-the-mud organization that, and lots of times the people who work there don't have a clue because they don't know what the other plants are doing. Oddest thing.
Yeah, I've also had a sense, and again, this is just my take on things, which it could be absolutely wrong, that it used to be a far more cooperative waterfront, and I'm not just talking like union management, but I mean even just companies.
Oh yeah, no cars. We did things like that, and even at West, I remember of the small elevator Grain Growers had in Vancouver. Then there was a trade off. We sent our cars to Sasquatchpool. They did our cars, and then Grain Growers said, you know what? We made more money then paying somebody else to do our cars. They were still getting some revenue from them, more profit, than when we operated our own elevator. But they, whether that was a totally joke or not, I can't remember. Yeah. But anyway, yes, there was lots of cooperation. Like I said, these people those days met at least once a week on various matters, dealing with allocation, dealing with what was coming up, if Richardson's was going to be wanting to shut down in August to do some maintenance and Cargill would take over some of their cars, we would take some of the sweep rules, things like that. They always, at the same time, tried to, these were always payback things too, so if we did 200 cars, well, I mean, they'd always try and cheat them a little bit or whatever it is. like two farmers out west, they do the same type of thing. When one looks after the earth, the other guy does properly what his job is. Right? Human nature, I think, always to try to get a little more out of a deal mm-hmm. than originally was contemplated.
I'm going to ask you a couple of quick questions here, mm-hmm. Just in case we don't get a chance to do anything more than mm-hmm. just our follow-up with you and...
Herb and Mike.
And Mike, right. So, I know it'd be a hard thing, but does anything pop into mind when I ask you what was the most significant memory that you have about your time on the job?
Well, there isn't, I can tell you, there isn't any there isn't any one thing. There's lots of exhilarations. I mean, being in a bin and looking up at 25 feet of pellets over your head and hitting that last bit with the shovel, hoping that what you've done in undermining is enough that it'll toss it. The grain will go this way instead of this way onto your head and kill you. And being exhilarated, like Churchill said, the most exhilarating thing he ever had in his life was to be fired upon without result. Those type of moments when you're doing things like that. Stefan, when he was talking about his bin cleaning career, would have had, he and I had a lot of similar attitudes about being down in that situation. It's, you're on your own, you've got a team that's responsible for saving your life, but you're doing things down there to get the work done. It's just... I knew a little bit more about where to stop than Stefan did. Stefan would go over the whole line because he's a crazy Frenchman. But both of us were definitely breaking you couldn't get the job done without going out on the edge.
Which is probably why I think Jerry Heinrich said this and not on tape, but I think he said to me once that we don't do that anymore. Like, we farm out.
None of them, they all farm out the liability. They think they're farming it out. They're not totally farming it out because they're responsible for how those people work in their yeah. plant. They can't avoid the liability, but that mm-hmm. is one of the reasons they get rid of it. We were the only one that did it for years and years. Jerry was never in a place where they did their own bit.
I mean,
people who were poisoned, who were temporarily poisoned with gas and in the old days because they didn't do any testing. So all they did was throw an oxygen thing down there, and it read the oxygen, but didn't read it fine enough to tell of any displacement of oxygen or whether this poison gas is being released once you opened up the hot bins. I mean, sometimes you're standing on burning bins. You're standing there with your boots burning. And hot canola. There's all kinds of gases that were released. We had one guy who possibly may have some issues to this day when he was continually exposed to heated flax, and that has, I'm forgetting the chemical right now, chemical that comes off it, and it creates a pulmonary problem, but it's, you don't notice at first, you may not notice the second time, but the third, it gets worse each time, so that the effects are much worse.
Almost like an asbestos thing.
Yeah, but the people who are actually injured, we had pretty good crews, pretty times, like anybody I've ever dealt with in confined spaces. The thing was, confined space, if you have an accident, it's basically fatal, you know. So we were very close to that, but it never happened.
Yes. So, and there's been real major advancements in safety procedures.
No, it took us 18 years to get those. Though I worked on it all during my career. For 18 years, I worked on it. It was worked on by people, including one of our general managers, Stan McKay, long before I was there, was working on these things. And the labor Canada was just ridiculous in trying to put any safety changes in. Then they became amenable to it because they saw that there was things on the market that they could actually use. Everything else prior to that, they regarded as an adaptation, had to be individually engineered and certified, but it was 2005, I believe, in October past. It hadn't come into Royal Assent, and the head of maintenance came up to me. I was working on the scale floor, and he says, "Tom, we're going to change the way we do the confined space," and he handed me a list of changes they were making. It was the list that we'd been asking for all these years, all the new equipment. And we'd looked year after year after year. Mike, what's his name from Catcher from Pool One, Mike Katusa and a bunch of guys from Saskatoon, some people from Cargill, the managers, we were all on committees looking at different equipment and things like that. When you got it, there was always some reason to stall. So it wasn't until, say, early to mid-2000s, when there was the threat of direct criminal liability for that stuff. The next year, I mean, before Royal Assent even came in, we had that modern equipment. Now, in the meantime, we'd managed to put in some of our own illegal adaptations that Labour Canada would never agree with. We had to make the equipment fast. We'd done things at one point at McCabe's. We actually hooked up so we could run it. It was hydraulic, and we could run that thing and pull the person out, hoping never to have to use it. But the fact is, we had to get the person out from the bottom within 4 minutes. It's the only way we could do it. Couldn't do it with the old chair and left the old Ferrano chairs. So we said we ran it through a pulley in the ceiling, and totally illegal, totally, some people would say irresponsible. In our case, no, it wasn't. We were able to get the guy, we could get the guy out. And to us, it was safer than not. And we developed procedures over the years. Again, our company did. And always ongoing, changing, growing procedures that reflected what the working conditions were in both places. We had certain crews that were only the only people who were authorized to go down the bins. Like I was a trainer myself, or what's called a qualified person. I always went down. We always picked our crews to see out of that group. So a foreman assigned crews that needed to be out of that group. It was people air testing. We got that early on in the 90s, and had to improve that every single time. It wasn't perfect, but we finally got the multi-testers and doing that kind of stuff. So I'd say both us and the companies did pretty well in getting and making it as safe as it could be. Labour Canada was a huge obstacle for us, especially in the 90s and the 80s. And then the last for us, the last kick at the, or the last huge improvement came because of that Westray bill. On the other hand, with people like
the Westray bill?
Bill C-83. I guess it was. It was after the Westray mine disaster in the 90s, so steelworkers fought for 11 years to have that passed. It was finally passed. The criminal responsibility for corporations who ignore safety issues. I remember it was funny, the one year in, might have been 2005 again, and John Malcolm was our main superintendent. So we'd done a work, and it was done in 2 days. So. They just misread the job. So then he had us on there. He had to find work for us. So he sent us out to do check out these spouts and on the D floor and various things like that. So he each thing we looked at needed repair. And so we went ahead and did that. And for that entire time until we were ready to do the rest of the job, which is about 4 to 6 weeks down the road. And John came to us and he said, Tom, he said, not just me, but he was talking to me. Quit looking up, because every time we looked up, we'd see another thing. And because of this new condition in the workplace, once you told them that safety thing existed, they needed to follow through on it, and it had to be seen that they followed through on it. So really, it could be, you know, create endless work. What Viterra did was the opposite. Our company kept, and Richardson's, kept their people working on this stuff, except for the bin cleaning. Viterra went the opposite way. They just said, okay, we'll just remove all that work out of the union's bailiwick, moving of the grain and shipping and all that kind of stuff. Any other type of work was taken away. So it was. So there were some good things that came out of it and some bad things, depending on how the companies reacted.
Did you have any sense of your place in Canada's success as a grain trader? Or were you
Definitely. No, we did. There's tremendous pride, right across, certainly was, right across the waterfront about how well we did in shipping and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that goes back to the question of involvement. And the companies lose that when they take that ability away from the individuals who work there, where you just say you come in and your job is to go and turn that wheel. You know, that doesn't help. It doesn't help them. We used to have competitions. I mean, you ask anybody on the waterfront who's shipping, at least the people I know, and you talk about their tonnage per hour, and they don't talk about milking it and doing 1,200 tons an hour. They talk about if you can get as close to 2,000 an hour at Viterra. They don't. It makes no difference to them. It's the oddest thing. I give an example. I don't know if you know anything about shipping spouts coming off a scale. But sometimes you can have two scales running into a shipping spout. Sometimes you can have three, depending on how the elevator is set up. When I worked my last December at Viterra, they were running two scales into a single shipping spout. They ran them both at full capacity as if one scale was running into the shipping spout. And all the time, they end up building back up into the scale and the garner and shutting off in the basement. So I talked to Bill Elchuk, who was one of the managers who's around the time, and he says, Bill, this, is this problem happened in McCabe's all the time. What we did was we cut the scale openings down because you have to maintain airspace in your shipping spouts so everything can flow. In any pipe, you have to have air in the pipe for things to run through. And he says, your overall tonnage, even though it looks like it's slower on the scale, your overall tonnage per hour is quite a bit higher. He said, that's not the way we do it in Viterra. And he was serious. So here they were. I was there for a week. Learning as shippers, it was my last week working there, and this is what they did. They just ran it and plugged. How the grain would just slowly come out the end of that pipe instead of that shooting up. The trimmers are going crazy because they need the force to come down there and move it around. That's the way they operate. And it makes no sense because they know the answer. They know what they should be doing, but it doesn't matter because that's what we do.
Not our way.
So, you know, I don't remember what your question was.
No, just whether you had a sense that you contributed to Canada's success as
trade. We definitely all would, you know, you go back to even what Herb had said in the early 90s in negotiations when they were talking about problems and talking in the Senate and this type of stuff, and we were talking to the companies, and we always said to the companies, I said, this is something we're committed to, absolutely committed to. This is our livelihood. This is Thunder Bay. This is our grain port. This is not fly by night. This is whatever the problems are. And he'd always said it, I bet every negotiations since then, if not before, we've always said it, is that we want to be part of the solution, not the problem. And that's always been the truth. Always been the truth. Trying to get people to believe that, like, I know Richie's does to a certain extent. The way they treat their employees, you can see how they treat their employees, how they are very proactive about everything. They're extremely proud. Our company certainly was that way as well. And sad when you see other ones that aren't, you know, that it's really being taken away. Mm-hmm. Because there is a lot of pride here. Like one guy asked me on the street the other day, he knows who I am, and he said, oh, he said, I didn't even know the elevators are still operating. I said, we could probably still ship, if we were shipping three shifts, we could ship close to the capacity of Vancouver. And we were always able to ship more than Vancouver. We could ship 18, they could ship 14 million. Even with the plants we have now, if you had the logistics, which you don't have, so it's a ridiculous statement, but if the logistics were there, we have the capacity and the know-how to ship far, far more than 6.5 million tons. We can easily be up to 10.
So logistics, for those of you listening who might not be aware, logistics would be having the right product in the right place at the right time.
And the right amounts. Yeah, having it there.
Yeah, could you say it instead of me? Because
no, you did it very well.
No, you need to say it because we won't have a snippet of Nancy, but we might have a snippet of Tom. So logistics would be?
Well, the right amount of the right product in the right place and the right amounts at the right time. And the transportation away out of the elevators, the shipping ability out of it, so it gets down to the ports. I mean, that's all part of it, the inward and the outward part of the logistics. It's never going to be perfect, but Thunder Bay Port, we have a real high potential for maximizing the logistic potentials.
Well, Monica McNabb, who is here, don't shut off yet. Any question that you'd like to ask that Tom could answer in 2 minutes? We need to talk at some point about, you're still working on a list of possible people. And when you think of all the people's names who you've named I've got Mike and Steve.
Right. And the other guy could be a very interesting interview with Randy McRae. You'd decide what he could use, what what you could use
whatever his name is. So can you find
him? Yeah, I think in the CGC his name was G. Randolph Morgan.
Yeah, can you track him down for us?
I can see. I can't contact him by phone or anything. I have to physically see him.
Yeah.
And where he is,
or somebody might know him, who knows
I know him. People who know him, but it doesn't matter. He doesn't have any phone or anything. He's
a character.
He lives with his girlfriend out towards Amethyst or something. Okay. And then sometimes he's in town. He has a house in Current River.
Okay.
And when I talked to him, he was very interested. He's quite a drinker, so it depends when you get him, man.
What's Mike's last name again?
Perron, P-E-R-O-N.
Did his dad work?
He was Red Lake. Mike's out of Red Lake. His dad was in the union and in the mines at Red Lake. And that's where Mike started as well. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. It's been another whirlwind chock full of information.
Yeah.
And we will get the three of you. Maybe the group will grow even bigger. Bob Antoniak, see somebody you could contact?
Well, I could ask Mike if Bob is interested in doing a... Bob's pretty old now, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
The last time I saw him, he was doing okay, but I would have to ask
his son. It's really weak.
He's very, very private, man.
Yeah. Well,
whether he'd be interested or not.
Well, just tell him, from your perspective, just how important this project is to have.
Oh, I'll talk to Mike for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks again, and we'll we'll try to get the three of you together at once. What are the chances of that?
It'd be nice to get, at the very least, Mike and Herb should be together.
So we're officially ending.